Up next, we'll hear a talk given at Reed College in October of last year. The speaker is Dr. Jane Lubchenco. She is an environmental scientist and marine ecologist who is actively engaged in teaching and research. She is Valley Professor of Marine Biology and Distinguished Professor of Zoology at Oregon State University. This talk is titled Environment and Human Well-Being. Here's Jane Lubchenco.
It's my pleasure tonight to bring to you some new information from the scientific community about one of the greatest challenges that we face. I refer to this new report, the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which has recently been released and gives us new information about what's happening, where we fit in the grand scheme of things, and what some of our challenges are. I had the pleasure of participating in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment over the last 5 years through a number of different portions of the Millennium Assessment. Like many international scientific assessments, this one is very detailed and has lots and lots of information. I'm only going to be able to hit on some of the highlights for you tonight, but I hope in so doing to give you a new framework for thinking about some of this information and a taste for what lies in the report, with the hope that many of you will take advantage of this information that is available, go to the website, and learn more about it. I'm going to structure my remarks tonight by focusing on some of the global scale changes that are happening as encapsulated in this Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. That will be, in fact, the bulk of my remarks tonight. I'm going to touch on some new opportunities for Oregonians that relate directly to topics that are in the Millennium Assessment, and then conclude with what I hope is a note of urgency as well as hope. In making these remarks to you tonight, I'm wearing the hat of a scientist. I believe passionately that scientific information is vitally important, not to dictate decisions that are made by individuals or by institutions, but to inform those decisions. In my view, scientific information should help us understand what's happening in the world, how fast it's happening, how the world works, how we interact with the world, to help us understand the logical consequences of different choices before us, and to help provide solutions. So it's in that spirit of science to inform that I intend to share information with you about this Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, or abbreviated Millennium Assessment, or MA. Many of you will have heard about some of the other international scientific assessments that we've had the benefit of hearing about, including the ozone assessment, which drew attention to the role of CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, in destroying the ozone in the stratosphere. That was one of the first big international scientific assessments that was conducted, and it indeed fed directly into serious action on the part of governments by way of the Montreal Protocol and other agreements since that have made significant progress in reducing the use of chlorofluorocarbons and allowing the ozone layer to begin to repair itself. So that was one of the first big international scientific assessments that we had. Another one that many of you will know about is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, which on a regular basis provides an update to the world about what is the scientific knowledge, what's the state of the scientific knowledge about climate change. That information from the IPCC has been eagerly anticipated and has provided grounding to our discussions about climate change and what we might do about it. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment was similar in the sense that it was an international assessment. It had scientists from 95 countries, over 1,300 of us, working together hard to summarize the state of knowledge about all environmental changes that are happening and what the consequences of those environmental changes are to human well-being. It was released in its big synthesis. The big synthesis documents were released only in March of this year, with more syntheses and the larger technical documents being released over a period of months. So much of it is still yet to come. The Millennium Assessment takes stock of the status of the world's ecosystems and what they provide to people. It takes stock of ecosystem services or the benefits that are provided by ecosystems. Every single ecosystem, whether it's a wheat field, an agricultural area like the cherries from this cherry orchard, a coral reef, a kelp forest, an estuary, or a forested ecosystem, each one of those ecosystems provides a range of benefits or services to people. Those benefits or services are different from one ecosystem to another. Obviously, the provision of food from the agricultural areas is a very important service. Coral reefs provide food as well. They also harbor great biodiversity. They recycle nutrients. Kelp forests, estuaries, mangroves are important coastal ecosystems. They too provide important services, as does an old growth forest. Forests, for example, obviously provide timber, but they provide other services, the purification of water. As water is moving through a forest, as it moves through the soil, there is detoxification and sequestration of pollutants. So there's a purifying service that is provided. There's a filtration service that is provided. Forests also provide flood control. That's another benefit. That's another service. And so on, from one to another type of ecosystem. These ecosystem services result then from the interactions between the plants, animals, microbes, and the physical environment. That's what makes an ecosystem. It's those interactions. And as the plants and animals and microbes in a system are all going about their business, doing what they do, those interactions provide the services. Converting an ecosystem from one state to another means trade-offs in those ecosystem services. It means losing some and gaining some. And the more we understand about what those trade-offs are, the better able we will be to make wise decisions about how much to convert, how to convert, what the kinds of options are for uses of these systems. I want to illustrate those trade-offs by focusing on mangrove ecosystems for a moment. Mangroves are incredibly complex ecosystems that occur at the margins of land in tropical areas where there is not hard substrate, but usually at the mouths of rivers where sediment is in and water is coming down a river. You see here the two images on the left and the center are intact mangroves seen above water, and then in the middle one both above and below the water. A mangrove forest provides a wide range of benefits. They provide nursery area below the roots for many, many economically important species ranging from shrimp to crabs to many species of fish. They also provide adult habitat for many of those marine creatures. Mangroves provide seafood. They provide fuel wood and timber. They also provide a very important service of trapping sediment as it's coming down a river. And in fact, when mangroves have been converted, for example, to shrimp ponds, oftentimes what happens is that sediment continues, instead of being trapped, it continues to downstream coral reefs and ends up smothering them. So that trapping of sediment is important. They also detoxify pollutants. And importantly, they protect shores against erosion, against the battering of waves. We saw in the Indian Ocean tsunami last December how critically important mangroves are in protecting shores against the battering of even great big huge waves caused by tsunamis. Areas that had intact mangroves suffered much less damage from those where the mangroves had been converted to other uses. So in the process of converting mangroves from a mangrove to something else, there are trade-offs. Seen on the right here are three of the kinds of conversions that are typically done for mangroves: converting them into places for people to live, shrimp farms, and the image there is from Thailand, or agricultural areas. And each of those conversions is obviously done for a benefit, for housing, for food. Historically, we haven't paid much attention to what is lost in the conversion, only what is gained in the conversion. And that's true not only for mangroves, but for forests, for prairies, for coastal estuaries, for almost any ecosystem you might want to mention. There's economic benefit in filling in a wetland to build places for people to live or an airport. There's economic benefit in harvesting timber. There are many in all of these instances. There is obvious benefit, but we haven't paid as much attention to what the trade-offs are. And that information about the trade-offs is vitally important and indeed is right at the core of this Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. Many of these ecosystem services are ones that we've never paid much attention to, and it's sort of like the Joni Mitchell song, "You don't know what you've got till it's gone." In many cases, as conversion is taking place, there is a loss that we haven't appreciated until something bad starts to happen. An example of that comes from New York. The Catskill watershed provides drinking water for the city of New York, and New Yorkers have long been exceptionally proud of their water. The quality, the quantity have been outstanding. How many of you are from New York? A few, so you can definitely appreciate what I'm saying. About a decade ago, New Yorkers were told by the Environmental Protection Agency that the quality of their drinking water was beginning to diminish. Something was happening. The city needed to figure out what it was and to do something about it, or EPA would have to step in. The city launched an investigation into what the causes of the degradation might be, and they discovered that in the watershed, a lot of different changes were happening. Land was being converted for urban areas. Agricultural areas were being intensified, so intensification of agriculture. More industrial uses were occurring. So pretty typical, little of this, little of that. The city was also told by two economists who looked at this that it had two choices. It could restore the watershed to provide the historic services of water purification and filtration, or it could build and maintain a water purification plant. And when those numbers were provided, people began to appreciate what it was that they were losing and how valuable it was. So just this one ecosystem service, water purification, from this one watershed, the cost of restoring the watershed was deemed to be about $1 billion. Alternatively, the cost of building and maintaining a water purification filtration plant was $8 to $10 billion. The city said, this is a no-brainer. We better figure out how to restore the watershed. And that's, in fact, the path that they have gone down. It's been sort of typical two steps ahead, one step back, but in fact, they are making progress, and this was the decision that was made. So this one example of an ecosystem service was a very powerful one in giving us information about the value, the economic value, of the replacement cost, in this case, $8 to $10 billion, of a service that had been provided free, that everybody had always taken for granted. The same taking for granted is true of most other ecosystem services. We don't typically pay attention to them until we start to lose them. And that, in fact, is what has been happening more and more. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment recognizes now that there are four different types of ecosystem services. The provisioning services are the goods that we get from systems. Food, fresh water, fuel, genetic resources are examples. Another category of ecosystem services are the regulating services. Climate regulation, ecosystems play a vital role in that, in sequestering carbon, for example. Disease regulation, flood regulation, water purification are all examples of regulating services. Equally important are cultural services, places for us to play, places to go and be inspired, places that are culturally important to many different heritages, places to go and learn, to do research, to find out about how nature works. Underpinning those three are supporting services. Supporting services don't benefit people directly, but they are absolutely required for all of those other three categories of services to exist. The provision of fertile soil, nutrient cycling, primary production are prime examples of supporting services. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment took stock of these services globally. What are the ones provided by forests? What are the ones provided by wetlands? What are the ones provided by coral reefs? How are those ecosystems doing, and how are the services doing? The assessment combed the scientific literature and utilized information only from the peer-reviewed scientific literature to do this assessment. It also provides a framework for understanding the connections between those different provisioning, regulating, cultural, and supporting services and human well-being, focusing on things people need to have secure lives, basic materials for good life, adequate livelihoods, sufficient nutritious food, shelter, access to goods, things people need for good health and for good social relations. And then cutting across those and underpinning all of those, freedom of choice and action. The Millennium Assessment had natural scientists and social scientists participating. And it stands as a remarkable success, in my view, of truly interdisciplinary interactions in creating this framework and providing a structure for us to connect the dots between all these environmental changes that are happening, how they modify ecological systems, how those changes change the provision of services, and how that in turn affects human well-being. So the Millennium Assessment really connects the dots between all those different things. Some of the findings of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment are as follows. Over the past 50 years, humans have changed the planet more rapidly and more extensively than in any comparable period in history. I think sometimes we tend to think of change as being fairly gradual and linear, but in reality, most of the changes that are described in the MA are very abrupt changes, coming increasingly faster and faster as we come up to the present time. There are three categories of ways in which ecosystems have been so dramatically changed. Transforming ecosystems is one. Modifying the basic chemistry of the planet, the biogeochemical cycles of the planet, is a second. And then loss of biological diversity is a third. An example of one of the major biogeochemical changes is... Did I skip one? No? Okay, sorry. One example of a major biogeochemical change is that of nitrogen in making a fertilizer and applying it on agricultural areas. Humans have inadvertently changed very dramatically the amount of available nitrogen that is present on Earth. There's plenty of nitrogen in our atmosphere, but it's not in a form that plants can readily use. It has to be chemically changed or converted. That happens naturally by the action of bacteria and algae. Humans deliberately convert nitrogen when we make fertilizers. We also inadvertently convert nitrogen when we burn fossil fuels. And the figure on the right shows you some of the ways or the changes in the amount of available nitrogen through time. And if you look just at the top line, the data there start in 1900 and go up, the solid line goes up to the present. And so the top blue line there shows that throughout most of the 1900s until about 1960, there was a very gradual increase in the amount of nitrogen that's biologically available. And then all of a sudden it increases very, very dramatically. That increase is primarily because of the use of fertilizers, which was growing very, very dramatically. And obviously fertilizers are intended to grow more crops, which is good and important. But the trade-off here that's being flagged is that there is more and more nitrogen that is biologically available. And this, in turn, has some negative consequences, one of which is shown on the left-hand picture here. You see in yellow the drainage basin for the Mississippi River, vast agricultural areas, lots of nitrogen. Much of the nitrogen that's applied to those crops isn't taken up by the crops, but in fact washes off and ends up going down the Mississippi and being deposited in the Gulf. And that excess nitrogen triggers the growth of microscopic plants in the Gulf, and that in turn triggers these zones of low to no oxygen, or so-called dead zones. And that's what you see in red there. That's the dead zone that has been growing in size and is now about the size of the state of Massachusetts, or it was before Katrina hit. I'm not sure exactly how that whole area is going to change as a result of the hurricane. The point here is simply that there has been a major alteration of a fundamental biogeochemical cycle of the planet, and this is one particular example. Another example of biogeochemical changes that are going on has to do with greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases that have significantly increased, especially over the last century, but even more rapidly the last few decades, with the consequence of increasing global average temperature of the planet. And not only is the planet as a whole warming, but our oceans are warming as well. And the figure that you see here is a temperature record starting in the year 1000, going up to the place where you see the lines diverge. That's the present, and then those are projections into the future with under different types of scenarios with different types of assumptions. So many of the environmental changes that are happening are interacting, and climate change is interacting with many of these other changes that are ongoing. So land transformations, biogeochemical changes, and loss of biological diversity are some of those changes that are underway. They have provided very substantial benefits to humanity. We note that between 1960 and 2000, the world population doubled. We went from 3 to about 6 billion people, and the global economy increased more than sixfold. Now, in order to meet the demand of a growing world, growing number of people, growing use of energy, growing demand for food, etc., much of that land was converted, more CO2 released, more nitrogen provided, etc., etc. So those changes that I described earlier have gone to meet this demand. Over this interval between 1960 and 2000, food production increased 2.5 times, water use doubled, wood harvests more than tripled, timber production increased by about 1/2, installed hydro capacity doubled. So many of these changes are going directly to meet a burgeoning human population. However, these gains have come at growing costs. Specifically, the degradation of many ecosystems and ecosystem services, increased likelihood of abrupt changes, and exacerbation of poverty for some groups of people. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment was able to evaluate the status of 24 ecosystem services and pose the question, how are we doing with these services? Are they increasing? Are they staying the same? Or are they decreasing at the global scale? Of the 24 services for which there was enough information to evaluate, the MA found that fully 60% of them are being degraded, and only 4 of them are increasing. And I'll show you some of the provisioning services and some of the regulating services to explain what's happening. This is the status of the provisioning services for which there's enough information to say how are we doing. A number of those are food, the provision of food, and it's broken down by crops, livestock, capture fisheries, aquaculture, wild foods, and then fiber, genetic resources, biochemicals, freshwater. Those are the different provisioning services. The up blue arrows are the services which are increasing. The reds are decreasing. And the plus minus means some parts of the world it's increasing, others decreasing, and so it's a wash at the global scale. The point here is that many of the land transformations, many of the changes in biogeochemical cycles that have happened have been designed deliberately or not to increase the provisioning services of crops, of livestock, and of aquaculture. We are indeed growing more food. We're growing more grains, we're growing more livestock, we're growing more seafood from aquaculture. The provisioning service that is noticeably going down is capture fisheries. We're not capturing more fish. In fact, we're capturing less. And for most of the other provisioning services, they are on the decline. The status of regulating services is, as you see here, only one of them is increasing, and that's climate regulation at the global scale. Air quality regulation is being diminished. Climate regulation at the regional and local scale is being diminished. Water regulation, etc., are on the down or awash. So of those 60 ecosystem, of those 24 ecosystem services, overall 60%, roughly two-thirds, are on the decline. So the pattern that is emerging from this analysis is that humanity has put a priority on the provisioning services for food for very obvious reasons, but in so doing, there has been a trade-off, that the ability to grow more food in the future is now being compromised because we're losing fertile soil, we're losing water availability, we're losing the other kinds of services that would be required to continue producing more food, etc. So the MA has focused on ecosystem changes over the last 50 years, I talked about that, the gains and losses from the changes, and we can look ahead to the next 50 years, what is on the horizon. It found that degradation of the same services that we just looked at could grow significantly worse during the first half of the century that we're in now. And the reason is that most of the drivers of change are continuing as they have over the last few decades. Most direct drivers of degradation remain constant or are growing in intensity. This very busy figure, and I apologize, it's pretty crazy, but it's actually pretty simple to get the main message, so bear with me. Down the left-hand side are different types of ecosystems: forests, drylands, inland water, coastal, marine, island, mountain, and polar. And across the top are different direct drivers of changes in each of those systems: habitat change, climate change, invasive species, overexploitation, and pollution. And the important thing to note here is simply the direction of the arrow. If the arrow is going up, then the driver is increasing rapidly for that particular system. If it's going up only slightly, it's increasing, but not quite as dramatically. If it's to the side, then it's staying level. And if it's going down, I don't see any downs, then it would be diminishing. So the point here is simply that many of the same forces that are resulting in loss of two-thirds of the ecosystem services now are continuing, and in fact many of them are increasing. The Millennium Assessment also looked long and hard at what options exist to be doing something differently. Could we utilize technology better? Could we make better decisions about how to use lands, how to grow crops, how to grow seafood, how to do any of those kinds of things? And it found that, in fact, there are many, many, many options to conserve or enhance ecosystem services in ways that reduce these negative trade-offs. However, it found that reversing the degradation while meeting the increased demands for services can be done, but would require very significant changes in policies, institutions, and practices. So it's possible, it's feasible. We can be doing things a lot smarter than we are, in ways that are less wasteful than they are, and in ways that are less destructive. But making the transition from current institutions and policies and practices into something that's more sustainable is a very, very tall order. The Millennium Assessment goes through and talks about options for doing things differently. talks about options for individuals, for communities, for businesses, for governments, and I would insert here, for colleges and universities. And there are indeed many, many options. And the MA has a wealth of suggestions about how to do some of those things differently. I'm just going to highlight a few for examples. And I'll pick on governments here. Governments could do a lot more to enable individual choices. Not command and control kind of thing, but giving people information, giving people choices. For example, public education on why and how to reduce consumption of threatened services, to establish reliable certification systems to give people choices to buy, for example, sustainably harvested products, giving people access to information about ecosystems and decisions that affect their services. Other things that governments can do would be to significantly enhance environmentally friendly technologies. Invest in agricultural science and technology aimed at increasing food production while minimizing harmful trade-offs. We desperately need that in aquaculture, for example. How can we grow more seafood, but in a way that is more sustainable and less destructive than what is often done? Restoring degraded ecosystems. Much of the billions of dollars that are going to be poured into Louisiana and other Gulf states in the aftermath of Katrina and Rita could well go to building up critically important wetlands that would have provided a buffer against the hurricane for those states. Those wetlands provide a range of ecosystem services, and to recognize the importance of those wetlands and instead of facilitating degradation and conversion of them, to actually restore. The same is true of the fisheries. The fisheries in the Gulf are very significantly overcapitalized, are not particularly sterling examples of well-managed fisheries. This is a prime opportunity, because they have been very significantly devastated, to utilize the federal dollars that will be going to restoration to address those fishery issues and put them on a more sustainable course. That would help build up the economy of the region, but in a way that is positive instead of some of the destructive practices that many of those industries engage in, etc. Restoring degraded ecosystems, promoting technologies to increase energy efficiency and reduce greenhouse gas emissions would be very appropriate. These are just examples and highlights. The bottom line of the Millennium Assessment, then, is simply that we are currently spending the Earth's natural capital. We're putting such strain on the natural functions of the planet that its ability to sustain future generations cannot be taken for granted. The future really is in our hands. We can reverse the degradation in many of these ecosystem services over the next 50 years, but doing so will require many changes in policies and practices. This is very big picture. It's very sobering. I'd like to ground it with some responses to the MA and some nods to some local issues that might provide opportunities to begin to do these transformations. I would note that there has been very, very keen interest on the part of the private sector in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. The document that's on the right is a synthesis of the MA for business and industry. I had the pleasure of co-chairing the synthesis team that wrote this, along with Steve Piercy.
Technical difficulties prevents us from playing the very end of it, and I apologize for that. We were listening to Dr. Jane Lubchenco, Valley Professor of Marine Biology and Distinguished Professor of Zoology at Oregon State University. She spoke at Reed College in October last year on environment and well-being. Do stay tuned for Stage and Studio. It'll be coming up in just a couple of minutes.